Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Welcome to Living the Solution with Dr. Elena George. Today we have a special guest, somebody who hasn't been on for a while, but somebody who I look up to highly. And I'd like to welcome back Mr. Brandon LaGreca. I'm looking forward to our conversation. It's been a year since he's been here, but I'm sure and I know he's been doing wonderful things since then. He grew up in the East Coast and attended Mount Clare State University, where he received a bachelor's degree in science with a minor in religion, summa cum laude. He then moved to the West Coast to fulfill a dream he had at the age of 12 of studying traditional Chinese medicine. He was accepted to the prestigious Oregon College of Oriental Medicine, where he earned a master's degree in acupuncture and Oriental medicine. His postgraduate work included studying and working at Nanjing University of Chinese Medicine in China. After 10 years of practice, Brandon experienced firsthand the journey of a wounded healer when a series of small bowel obstructions led to hospitalization, a diagnosis of stage 4 non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. He achieved remission 8 months later, following an integrative oncology protocol that included immunotherapy without surgery, radiation, or chemotherapy. He now lectures and writes on the epigenetics of cancer and has dedicated his career to empowering patients through and beyond chronic illness such as cancer. His latest interests include studying indigenous forms of healing and eco-spirituality. He's the author of Cancer and EMF Radiation, How to Protect Yourself from Silent Carcinogen of Electropollution, and Cancer, Stress, and Mindset, Focusing the Mind to Empower Healing and Resilience. And you can reach him on empoweredpatientblog.com. So, Brandon, I want to thank you so much for joining me today, because this is a topic I think is touching so many people in the world. And I think we need to have a different approach, different mindset towards chronic illness and specifically cancer. So thanks again for your time.
Oh, thanks for having me back on. It's always good to hear your voice, Dr. George.
Oh, it's always a pleasure. You know, you have a very unique journey. And, you know, most people, I think, would have let it take them. But you took the opposite approach. I think we had a conversation with you being a warrior. And I think that's really how everybody has to see themselves now. You have a practice that I'm sure you see a ton of patients. But in your experience, is cancer becoming more of a problem, more prevalent?
I think it certainly seems so. You know, it's still the second leading cause of death in the United States and in the Western world, but I think it's going to potentially surpass cardiovascular disease as the number one disease and killer. It's certainly in everyone's awareness more than it's ever been. And I think what I have been seeing more, I would dare to say, in the last 2-3 years, a lot more incidences of cancer in younger and younger people. Which is particularly disturbing. And, you know, it used to be one of those things that we thought about cancer as just a disease of aging because, of course, the standard line of thinking, which is the older you get, the more random or stochastic mutations could happen and the more likely someone's going to succumb to cancer. But now we have to really think differently about this, because now we're seeing cancers, of course, in children, unfortunately, but then also people middle-aged, younger, including myself and my story. So that really begs this larger question about, you know, what are these environmental or epigenetic influences that are really driving cancer rates the way that we're seeing them now?
Now, when you talk about epigenetics, for those who don't really understand that principle, what is that exactly?
So epigenetics literally means upon the genes. And think of it this way, you know, we get a genetic inheritance from our mother and our father. And that determines a great many things. And we call that the nature of our biology. But there's also the nurture of our biology, which is how do those genes express themselves throughout our lifetime. And so when it comes to something like cancer, you realize that everybody has things like oncogenes or predispositions to cancer, or they have tumor suppressive genes that are supposed to be active and keeping their body from forming these precancerous cells. But what happens is these genetics can just go haywire, and then suddenly we have malignancies that can occur. And the reason why is that those genes are getting turned on. And so we have to think about what are the influences from our environment that are affecting our genes and causing that expression. And that's what epigenetics is in a nutshell. Now, what I like to do is divide that into two distinct camps, which is really the focus of my writing. One of those is to stress very heavily the influence of environmental toxins and toxicants. And just because, quite simply, and it's pretty self-evident for most people, we are surrounded by certain chemicals that are clearly carcinogenic. And carcinogen, by definition, is something that acts upon our genes, causes mutation, and then leads to malignancy. But there's a second story that I like to tell, and that is that there's also ways that our genes can be affected, again, epigenetics, through how we think, our beliefs, our emotions, traumas that we experience. And this is the internal aspect of how genes can change and be expressed within our lifetime. And so within my native cord of traditional Chinese medicine, we say there are internal causes of disease and there are external causes of disease. I just gave you one of each, environmental in terms of carcinogens and internal in terms of trauma, stress, things of that nature. And where those two meet and where they interface is for me the art of medicine. And so those are the two epigenetic stories of cancer that I refer back to.
I love that. I think that that's so nuanced and it gives a whole new mindset of Western medicine because it's really very cut and dry. You know, I've had patients who've taken genetic testing and they may come up with a gene that may be predispose them to cancer per se. But there doesn't seem to be any thought really about what you just said about the deeper aspect, the mindset, the things that either unlock or suppress really what goes on. And so I wonder if people would think more broadly about this, will we have as many surgeries, for example, to pre-treat and to amputate or cut out whatever may be a problem down the road?
Absolutely. And furthermore, to your point, you know, we have to think about cancer as a process. You could excise a tumor from someone's body, but that doesn't mean you've changed the microenvironment. It doesn't mean you changed the soil for which that seed of cancer has grown. And so in holistic and integrative medicine, like you and I practice, we always think about the terrain of the body. The seed is one thing, and yes, you could have a predisposition to a certain cancer, but whether or not that expresses itself is ultimately a function of the soil that that seed is planted in. What is the terrain of the body? What is the health? What is the resilience of the body? And then to take it one more tier above that, what is the weather that that seed and soil is being exposed to? And for us, that's just our environment. What are the things we're being exposed to? So it's all of those things collectively that, I agree, make this nuanced understanding of what cancer is as a process and how we can think about it differently.
Now, on a, you know, taking a 1,000-foot view, do you think that the society, you know, the environment that we all find ourselves in, which is toxic and stressful, pervaded with anger, anxiety, all the things that make the stress levels go up, is that something that overall, you know, from a societal standpoint, also may be a driving factor?
Absolutely. When it comes to stress, I think of it twofold. I think of it that there are direct consequences from stress in our body at a metabolic and physiological level, which can be drivers of the cancer process. Just plain and simple. I mean, whenever we're stressed, our cortisol goes up. And as a long-term stress hormone, cortisol does things like, you know, have our blood sugar be elevated, and inflammation can get out of hand, our gut can get all torn up from having excess cortisol. So there are definite ways that we know that there's ways that our body gets affected very directly by the stresses that we encounter. But then there's the indirect ways. I mean, how do we cope with stress? Very poorly for most people, right? They're turning to addictions, for instance, like smoking or drinking, which themselves are directly carcinogenic. So if we really ask these difficult questions and get to the core of what people are doing and why they're doing it, we see this pattern of how stress plays out in multiple different arenas that can undermine our health and potentially jumpstart the cancer process.
So from, I know this is kind of a big question, but how does somebody assess themselves? Everybody is so busy interacting with outside, but they don't really look at themselves and sit with themselves and really understand their motivations. What do you recommend, you know, from a Eastern medicine standpoint, how does somebody really get started to becoming attuned? You know, something's wrong, right? You're not happy. You're in a situation that you feel connected to for whatever reason. How do you, what do you recommend that people do to start disengaging from this negativity?
That's a beautiful question. And in fact, it's really the perfect question that I try to get to with any new patient who comes to my clinic. And that's the heart of it, because my mission really is to restore agency within a patient, right? Mm-hmm. To really get them empowered and to take their health into their own hands. And so that is really the right question to hone in on what that could be. And I'll give you a couple ideas. I think for one, we're just a very distracted culture. You know, we've got these wonderful magical devices that we have on us called cell phones that we can be tuned into anything happening anywhere in the world practically anytime. And I think it's one thing to appreciate that, and it's another to know when to set limits. For me personally, I have one day a week where I don't have any electronics on whatsoever, and it's my detox day. And that's a day where I do a lot of thinking and contemplation and reflecting. But even just as far as having a limit, saying, you know, after 7-8 o'clock at night, it's off, I'm going to wind down, or not going to turn it on until maybe I get to work, so I have some morning time for reflection. So just really being honest with ourselves about distraction and how that's playing out. Another is, as you mentioned, the negativity. You know, there are definitely times I'll go on long fast from media altogether just because of the negative nature of it. Yes, you need to be informed, but you don't need to be hit over the head with all the bad things that are going on in the world either. So to have limits with yourself on that. And then finally, you know, once you create a little bit of time in your day, whether it be the beginning or the end of that day, is to really just reflect simply about where do you can get the most bang for your buck for your time. You know, I try to really hone in on that with a patient and say, you really know, be honest with yourself. If there's one thing you know you can change right now that'll give you the most impact, what would it be? Would it be you just got to work on your sleep? Or maybe you know your diet really is the core of what's going on for you, and that's where you need to work. Figure out what that one thing is, and let's start aligning ourselves with working on that one thing.
Do you find that once they identify that one thing, that empowerment just boosts their ability to make a change?
Absolutely. And it steamrolls into the next thing that they want to work on, the next thing. So it becomes what we say is a virtuous cycle as opposed to a vicious cycle.
I like that. I mean, there's one thing that I think is pervading society is this feeling of powerlessness. Things are happening to you, around you, and there's nothing, no one's listening to anybody. They just steamroll people in terms of what you should think, how you should be, how you should interact with each other. And it's not normal. It's not organic or authentic at this point. And do you think that inauthenticity, if that's a word, I think it is something that doesn't jibe with the person, with your spirit, and that disconnection, it's not harmonic. Is that the thing that sets people off?
Absolutely. And, you know, to put it in one context, again, Chinese medicine, you know, if you ask someone to, and your, you know, listeners, you can do this now, point to yourself. You know, what do you do? Most everybody, when I've gone to a room and lectured, and I tell everyone, point to yourself, everyone points to their chest. No one points to their head. And this is a really interesting, you know, idea, because in Chinese medicine, we say the spirit of the individual, you know, the true quintessential nature of that being resides within the heart. We call it the Shen in Chinese medicine, the spirit. And, you know, the brain's just a processor. The brain is actually an afterthought in Chinese medicine. It's not even one of the major organs. Yes, the brain's important. Without it, we can't live normally within, you know, society. However, the quintessential nature of who we are in terms of expressing ourselves and our creativity and new thought, all of that happens from the impetus of the Shen coming forth from the heart. So, you know, what I tell people is, like you say, you know, you try to find that quiet space and then listen deeply, you know, begin within. And begin within for me means going into the heart space, maybe breathing through the heart. You know, some of these wonderful techniques that we've been given from the Heart Math Institute. Breathe through the heart, reinforce that that is the seat of your consciousness, that that is the seat of your being, and that's where you listen from. And it plays out in different ways. It plays out in intuitions. It plays out in inspiration. It comes out in dreams. But all these different ways that our heart spirit talks to us is the language in which we need to live our lives.
I really feel that if people could do that, then once you have this sense of self and your purpose and you're right, your inspiration, nothing takes you off that place. You're very solid. So all of these things that come at you from the media about how you're not good enough, or you need to look a certain way, you need to buy this product or join this group, you don't need to, right? You've got this foundation and you're going to kind of watch this pass you, but you feel, how can I put, empowered and stable. Yeah. And I guess from that standpoint, cortisol levels don't seem to take control in that instance.
You're definitely a little bit more insulated. And so that does help for sure.
And what about faith? Does faith also play a role in here? Now, religion aside, just faith in a higher power.
Absolutely. Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree with that. And I think the reason why is because, you know, we're beings in randomness, right? I mean, there is a certain amount of wonderful things that happen and there's serendipities and such, but you know, we live in a co-creative universe and what we're putting forth in the world is always bouncing off somebody else's. And so there's a lot of uncertainty and, you know, there's ways that we have to cope with that. And then having faith that there's, you know, that there is maybe more of a divine order to how the universe unfolds and specifically unfolds in your life can certainly keep you motivated. It can certainly keep you focused. And I think from that place, then we can live as mentally, emotionally in tuned with things that are happening around us as much as anything.
And, you know, we're going to take a break in a couple of minutes, but I want to start or segue the conversation. We talked about a lot of things that drive people. What about anger? Is that an emotion that, I mean, it can obviously manifest in the obvious ways, but what happens when it goes internally?
So that's a really good question. You know, anger has two sides to it. You know, it can be used to mobilize somebody. For instance, if they've just been on the couch and depressed and just completely despondent, you know, you can get them fired up and get them more willing to have agency in their life. And so there's ways that you can use a positive spin on drive that can be fueled by this emotion, anger, which we say predominantly is expressed itself in the liver. But of course, there's the flip side of that, which means anger that's either repressed or that's overly expressed can damage the liver function, we say in Chinese medicine, can cause other imbalances in the body in terms of the blood not moving and the energy of the body just being stagnant. We say it definitely stagnates a person when that anger is repressed in that way.
Got you. Well, let's take our first break and come back. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living Solution. We're speaking with Mr. Brandon LaGreca. And again, you can go to Amazon and find his books, Cancer and EMF Radiation, and Cancer Stress and Mindset. I think we were really honing in, I think, on the first book in terms of stress, how you handle it, and what tools you have to work your way through this. Now, I have done things like Chinese Eastern medicine, Qigong, and Reiki, and these sorts of modalities. Are these things that people can use to balance themselves so they can actually get some wherewithal to enter this fray?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think one of the beautiful things about specifically Qigong and Tai Chi, those practices, I mean, they are internal in the sense that you really feel energy moving through the body. And when I teach it, that's what I focus on. For one example, Tai Chi is considered an internal martial art. You know, the movements that you do, although they're very slow, if they were sped up, they would be a strike or a block or something like that. But I don't teach that aspect of it when I teach Tai Chi. What I focus in on, what is happening inwardly as you move in this particular way, as you maybe bring your arm around in a wide arc, do you feel the energy moving through your arm? Do you feel like there's something either lifting it up, there's a buoyancy there, or something that's allowing it to gently drift down again? It's really a somatic practice. The more that we do these kind of practices that are very mindful in how we move our body, the more that we can cultivate this energy within us. And so I would say, you know, in my world, doing acupuncture day in and day out, I feel qi. I feel very tangibly this energy when I work with patients with the pins that I use and in my hands, and they feel it in their body. And so by doing these practices like Qigong, Tai Chi, and so on, you learn to get to feel that energy yourself. And it starts in this beautiful progression. I mean, first you do it and you feel there's something there. There's something moving. And then there's becomes this wonderful expansion that after you do it for some period of time and you get some more fluency with it, then the energy almost starts to move you. Mm. And you feel like you are being guided by that energy. It's underlying your movements. And then at that point, you realize you're part of something much larger. And then the whole world opens up to new and fun ideas.
Well, you just said a mouthful. I mean, imagine going from your little closed off wall, you know, world that's what you of lack to abundance, to something bigger than yourself. I think that's what people are missing, right? It's always about me, but it's not about the bigger picture anymore. And people can get so myopic and ego driven and selfish. And it's not alignment with the soul, I don't think, or health for that standpoint.
Absolutely. And that's kind of going back to that, again, that heart-centeredness, that heart-centered consciousness, that if we come back to that, you know, that guidance will be there for us.
Well, this is just, to me, that you just describe how people empower themselves and take their power back. Because if you really understand and are attuned to you, how your body's working and the energy within and outside, and you can control it, that's, I mean, ultimate power. Nothing gets in your way because you have a way to work outside of it and manifest what you want. Is that a way to see it?
Absolutely. And I'll give you an example. You know, when I work with patients and I get them into that space and they can hear that voice within themselves, that is where we get the best information from. And over again, I work with patients and guide them that, yes, I can take you through X, Y, and Z functional medicine tests, and I can get some data about this part of your physiology. But with so many things, it really comes down to what you feel in your experience is either serving you or not serving you. Mm-hmm. Diet is a great example of that, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I could do testing on people and I can get some very valuable information for that. But when you really have a person who's tuned in enough, they'll know. They'll basically be able to tell you straight out, you know, these foods work for me and these foods don't. And it doesn't matter what they've read in any book. And it doesn't matter what any doctor tells them. They know from their own experience what genuinely is working for them. And the same thing's true of so many different rhythms in life and different features of lifestyle. You can't be so didactic about this that everyone needs to have this much water per day and exercise this many minutes a day. That's not how I operate. I want my patients to be so engaged in the process of their own life that they will know on a day-to-day basis how to regulate. Maybe today they're not going to exercise because they didn't sleep as good last night. They're going to go easy on themselves. You know, maybe tomorrow is a day where they know they just need to drink more water because they're going to be out on a hot day. You know, they have to be able to self-regulate. The power is within you to make those choices. But we have to get people there to recognize that their intuition about their own health supersedes anything else they're told or can be or read about or learn about in terms of health.
I think you just described really to me, like, again, the art of medicine. You're just expressing something that's not going on in the standard healthcare system where it's all evidence-based and algorithm-driven. It's the opposite of someone having intuition and running their own body in their healthcare in the way that they deem is right for them. It is not the system that most people find themselves in. And I think there's a rebellion brewing, frankly. And I've seen people are tired of being put on a conveyor belt where, you know, just get it done, take a pill, and if it doesn't work, I can't help you. That's kind of where people are. And I think they're, at least my patients are waking up to the fact that there's something better. I mean, people need to want more for themselves, and that it comes down to self-love, right?
Yeah. And I think what you just hit upon, which is really interesting to me, is really the difference between knowledge and wisdom. You know, like you just said, Our system of thinking in our system of medicine in the West, in terms of conventional biomedicine, they really play to the averages. Everything is about randomized controlled trials of drugs, what have you. And it's about finding out what could be the most efficacious on the average for the average person. And that's great. It's good to have that information. For instance, it's really helpful to know that a wonderful herb like Echinacea angustifolia, that by testing that herb, we can know which particular species and how it's grown can produce the most amount of phytochemicals for our body. But that's a very different question than, for instance, asking, is Echinacea right for me on an individual level? And that's where wisdom comes in. It's nice to know what a thing does. It's nice to be able to describe it. And it's nice to have all the trappings of reductionist thinking to grant us those things. But at the end of the day, whether or not you proceed with that thing or whether or not it's appropriate for you, Yes, that's an N of one, right? That's always going to come down to you, mm-hmm. your relationship with that thing, and your own intuition about what is right for you in that moment.
I think a corollary to that is your relationship with your practitioner. Is it one where it's really, like you described, didactic, where I'm pronouncing on high and you get in line or you don't? Or your approach where it seems more of a team, where you are sharing energy, where you are coming to the right answer for that individual patient, but you're doing it together.
Absolutely. And I will tell you, for instance, cancer is one of those areas where that comes up in spades. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, you can have someone come in, they'll have researched a dozen different things as it relates to cancer, maybe more. And there's another 1,000 on the internet that they can possibly look into and consider. And, you know, maybe my job to curate that information that they've looked into is to say, well, given your case and given what's going on, I would say probably several things here are going to be the most valuable to you, the most evidence-based. However, now is where we have the discussion. What is most appropriate for you, given your presentation? And that's thinking more about not the condition of the person, but the constitution. You know, who is the person in front of me? That's a very different question, right? There's a distinction between the disease that's affecting the person and then the person who has that disease. And it's that latter statement that I really lob onto. Who is the person in front of me that's expressing this disease at this moment? And what do we really need to speak to the needs of that person in that moment? And that's, again, that wisdom principle coming out.
That's a very good point. But that takes a very mature relationship. And I think also patients need to make that leap where they want to take responsibility instead of being told what to do. That's another huge jump, is it not?
Yeah, we can hope that that's what the average person does. I would say that the average person who comes to see us, that is absolutely true. And clearly there are people who still unfortunately come or lead with the mindset that they're like a machine, that when it's broken, they go to a mechanic to get it fixed. And frankly, those are the people that Western conventional medicine is really designed for. I mean, this procedure, or I need this drug, and they don't really want to take any interest in their health or wellness. But for those who have woken up to the principle that, you know, they can be in charge of their own health and they can change things. Yes, for that person who's engaged and on fire, man, we can as a team work together and do a lot for them and with them.
Oh, it's very exciting. It's rewarding. You get energized when you have that type of interaction with your patient. Now, I know we're going to take a break soon, but I wanted to go into foods because I know that's one of the main questions that people have. So on a broad scale, let's just get some truths out there. Is sugar bad? Can you have sugar in your diet, or do you recommend that people get rid of it?
I think the average person would do far better having far less sugar in their diet. Absolutely. Is it an absolute all or none thing? I don't think it's that simple. I'll put it to you this way. Most people are definitely over consuming sugar, and it's definitely deranging their metabolism. Now, whether or not there's a place for the 80-20 rule, or maybe even the 90-10, you could certainly make the case of something that it was maybe homemade with just a little bit of sweetness coming from a natural sweetener. Absolutely. I mean, our bodies do need the minerals from things like maple syrup and honey. But when we're talking about processed or refined sugar, I would say no. There's usually no place for that in the diet of a human being. We certainly didn't evolve with refined sugar the way that we're being bombarded with it. And that and high fructose corn syrup, for instance, those two things being bombarded in our bodies and our food supply like they never have before in the evolution of our species.
And are they inflammatory? Is sugar, does it feed cancer cells? Is that one of the reasons that you don't want to do it?
Well, cancer cells certainly love sugar. Glucose is their main fuel. Now, it's not their only fuel. Cancer cells will pretty much get whatever they need to. But I'll just make my point by saying, you know, a PET scan, which is the darling scan to look at cancer activity in the body and potential sites of metastases. In order to get a PET scan, basically what you do is get injected with radioactive glucose, and then you sit under the scanner. And so what we know is where that glucose is taken up much more readily, and at the rate at which it's taken up tells us the aggressiveness of the cancer. So there's absolutely no doubt that cancer cells love sugar. Now, whether or not that's end all and be all, I mean, I think there's a lot more to it, of course, but as one guiding principle to eliminate sugar from your diet, need a whole food, healthy, you know, healthy food, unprocessed food? Absolutely.
Gotcha. And how important is, I got to ask, how important is water? And is all water created equally?
Oh, well, that's a great question. Absolutely not. I would say that hydration is individualized, but generally people will tend to underhydrate. So we need to have a discussion of what to look for in terms of their own markers about whether or not they are hydrated. But not all water is created equal. So for instance, there's the purity of the water, which we have to think about ways to either have some kind of point of use filtration or reverse osmosis for someone who has really bad water, some kind of filtration to clean the water. And then there's the idea of what we put in the water, things like oxygen or hydrogen, and how the water is structured itself that can be more hydrating. And that lends itself to a whole nother layer of health or living water, as I like to say, as opposed to just dead water coming out of the pipes.
Is alkaline water really important? Is it medicinal or is it?
You know, my opinion on this, and I've looked at this specifically, alkaline water, oftentimes what makes it alkaline is the hydrogen ions and how they're interplaying in the water. And I almost wonder if the alkalinity of the water is just more a proxy for how healthy that water is. But you can have almost like an antioxidant quality of water without actually even altering the pH as well. And so I think what I've come to realize is focusing on hydrogen and oxygen content in the water, and specifically hydrogen. I mean, people can buy hydrogen generators now to make hydrogen water. And that, to me, has the most benefit in the long haul in terms of really being truly living water. Now, there may be some instances where alkaline water might have its uses. But in general, I would just say if people want to drink alkaline water, and it does have some interesting health benefits, just don't drink it around your meals, because obviously when you're eating, you want to fit it in your stomach. You don't want to counteract that. But alkaline water in an empty stomach could have its place for sure.
That's a very good point. And just from a biochemical standpoint, is the extra hydrogen, is it because it donates an electron and it's able to neutralize free radicals? Is that why it's important?
Yep, absolutely. It acts like an antioxidant in that stage.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty cool. And imagine you can just have antioxidant capacity just based on how much water you drink, as opposed to having to do anything. Because you're not getting a twofer, essentially. You know?
Indeed.
Oh, I love it. So my next question is organic. I know what the answer is, but I got to ask. Organic versus processed.
Yeah. I mean, conventional produce, conventional meat, conventional dairy, you're always taking the chance and rolling the wheel here about how much pesticides or besides chemicals are going to be exposed to, hormones and so on and so forth. And so by all means, to the extent that you're able, you know, either grow your own food, backyard gardens, organic, right? Because you can control the variables.
Right.
Buying from a farmer's market, so you get to know your farmers. They may not be certified organic, but if they can look you in the eye and say, "I don't spray any chemicals on my plots," then you know you're getting something good. Mm-hmm. And then beyond that, for when you can't have those personal interactions, then we have to rely on organic standards to tell us that something has not been sprayed with those chemicals.
Got you. So the next question would be sleep. How important is sleep in resetting and balancing the immune system and basically helping the body recover after being assaulted all day?
Absolutely. So our main window to repair ourselves is while we sleep. And it's interesting, the last several years, we've gotten more data on what's called the glymphatic system. There's this lymph system internal to the brain itself, where the brain can actually cleanse itself and detoxify. And that only happens while we sleep. And so, you know, on many levels, not only is it happening on a physiological level, but you even think about just the act of dreaming and how we process the events of the day and how we maybe set the stage for, you know, the future by the things that we dream about. We can have inspirational dreams, for instance, that can guide us. All those things can only happen if we're getting an adequate amount of sleep. And specifically about dreams, it's interesting to point out the first half of the night, we tend to have more deep sleep within our sleep cycles. And then it switches that towards the morning that we have more of that really REM, deep, informative sleep. And so where do most people shortchange themselves? Well, they fall asleep, they get their deep sleep right away. But if they have a short night of sleep and they get up early or earlier than their body would like, what are they getting shortchanged of? All that beautiful REM sleep, that really meaningful, you know, symbol-rich sleep that can actually help guide us and give us information about our lives.
I think that's really good advice. I think people are sleep deprived. They're too busy being distracted with work, internet, watching TV, all sorts of things that they didn't exist, you know, years ago. And I think we got much better quality of sleep. It seems like we don't unplug or not able to unplug from things that cause the anxiety. If people are watching, reading all sorts of things that are negative and toxic, you really can't disconnect. So how can you detox if it's a constant drone? Makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's take our last break, because when we come back, I want to go over the external. We talked about the internal things that drive us. What about the external things like EMF? Because that is a whole nother ball game. So let's take our last break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking with Mr. Brandon LaGreca. And Brandon, again, you can find your books on Amazon, correct?
Yep, they're on Amazon. They're also available on my website, which is just brandonlagreca.com.
Oh, I like
that.
Multiple
different versions between ebooks and audiobooks and however you like to interact with my writing.
Excellent. And if people want to see you as a patient, are you taking new patients?
Not so much at the moment.
Okay.
I'm pretty swamped. I do have some time that I leave set aside for doing consults for people to do nutritional and herbal consults. And I can even do that over the phone, over Zoom. I do that generally on Wednesday mornings. But in terms of inpatient kind of acupuncture and all that, no, I don't have as much time for new patients anymore. But if someone really wanted to reach out to me, I can see what I can do for them.
Well, I appreciate that. I know you just, I mean, don't run yourself too ragged, but you're it's much appreciated, let me tell you. So let's talk about EMF. There's so much out there, isn't there, about whether it's been tested, whether it's safe, whether it does affect us from an energy point of view, from a cellular health standpoint. Where do you stand on EMF? I mean, is there safe versions of it? We'll talk about how we minimize it, but in general, is it safe to be around, to have it near you, on your person, like your cell phone?
Yeah, I do not believe so. Now, we can't avoid it at this point completely. We can certainly minimize, but we're all being exposed to ever-increasing amounts of electromagnetic fields. And I'll put it to you this way. I so wanted to answer this question, which is why I wrote a book on EMF, and specifically, can EMF be a carcinogen? And the conclusion that I came to, people could form their own conclusions, but looking at the science and looking at the evidence, I have concluded that if nothing else, the action of electromagnetic fields, now non-native, which just means, you know, artificial or, you know, the kind of EMF that we are creating and putting in the environment, but specifically that kind of EMF, has enough potential to cause DNA damage that I think it absolutely should be categorized as a human carcinogen. At the current moment, it's cataloged as a possible carcinogen, which just means there's some evidence of it, but it's not conclusive. I think if someone really looks at this deeply, the evidence is really there and that it is conclusive. And I think we're on the front end of that research curve. Now, what do I mean by that? Look at something like cigarette smoking. You know, there was a time where it was completely accepted and, you know, so-and-so doctor would recommend this brand of cigarettes, okay? Now we have the benefit of looking back and saying, oh, well, of course, we know it's completely self-evident that cigarettes cause lung cancer. We're on the other side of that research curve. We have a very mature understanding of what cigarette smoking can do to us specifically. For something, let's say, we'll take the example of cell phone use and brain tumors, you know, glioblastoma. I think we're on the front end. You know, when I looked at this issue, you're starting to see these inklings in the literature coming up of 10, 15 years of cell phone use that we're getting the epidemiological evidence that there is a significant increase of glioblastoma with, you know, long-term use of cell phones. So it may be just like cigarette smoking that way, that we don't have the benefit of looking decades to know backwards how this has all been affecting us. So my advice to people is then just apply the precautionary principle as much as possible. You know, you can avoid EMF if you can, you know, in some instances you can't, but then for those instances where you could not, you can always choose to try to shield yourself from it in some ways or mitigate it in other ways. So there's different strategies that I detail in my book, but it has to start with that awareness that it is absolutely a problem. And not only that, what we're really dealing with is just the proliferation. And I think that's the single most important concept to take away is it's not any one thing. People ask, oh, is 5G a problem? Well, yeah, 5G is a problem, but so is 4G and 3G and everything that came before it. It's the proliferation. It's how these things are stacking up one on top of the other. And now we're living in these smart houses that have devices that are emitting 24/7 from multiple locations. So it's really an issue of that we're not unplugged anymore. We are completely surrounded by all this positive ion generating electronic devices. It's very different than being out in nature barefoot on the ground, absorbing all the negative ions in this environment that which we evolved. So it's a long answer, but basically, you know, the nuance around this is that there are so many things that we're being exposed to and so little of them are tested in combination. We look at one single thing and one single factor as a variable. But what is it really doing, all of those exposures in the context of all the stresses and lifestyle stuff going on? It's a smoldering pot, no doubt.
I want to backtrack to ions and positive versus negative. Can you explain, for if you can, how positive ions are toxic to us? You know, I think our cell membrane potential is a negative energy or negative potential. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yep, that's correct. So at face value, here's the first thing. We live on the surface of the Earth. This is where we evolved, and that's a negatively charged environment biologically. If you look at our atmosphere like a battery, you know, up in the ionosphere, it's positively charged. Down on the surface of the Earth where we live, it's negatively charged. And the differential between those two is actually what causes lightning strikes. So we evolved in a negative ion environment, and our body takes up those negative ions in mass in order to have that kind of antioxidant type of potential and to keep that negative charge. Well, it just so happens that all the electronics that we are exposed to, a lot of them emit positive ions around us. That's just by nature of electricity. And so that imbalance means we could sustain this environment where we are not within the normal electronic conditions of which our body is used to. And so, yeah, we can hedge for that. We can go outside and walk around barefoot for a little bit and absorb some of those negative ions. But it's just the frequency at which we're contacting all these positive ions that's having this imbalance that's becoming exacerbated.
Does that analogy carry over to why you want to drink hydrogen infused types of water? Does the hydrogen counter that?
Yes, it does to some extent. That's absolutely the case. Right. So we can use that as a hedge for sure. And just, you know, and this is self-evident too. I mean, everyone kind of knows you're walking barefoot on the beach. You've got the sunshine, you know, on your arms. You've got the waves lapping on your legs. I mean, your body, you're just absorbing all the negative ions that are coming off from the crashing waves and being in contact with the earth. You feel good in that environment. Of course, that's the environment which we are really replete with all these negative ions. The opposite of that, which is say being in a room just full of devices going off all the time, being disconnected from the earth, it's a totally different feeling in your body. And again, everyone kind of knows that when they think about it.
I guess they're so removed from what's natural now that it's foreign. You know, it's just going back to nature baths, isn't it? Getting away, like you said, having at least a day like you do where everything's off and being able to listen to your body. We just had a conversation about how powerful it is when you can feel the energy and you can take control over what's happening on your, you know, internally. Mind and body are connected. It just seems that we have so much more power to control our bodies and our reality and our health that we give ourselves credit for.
Absolutely. Yep. That is the core of our being right there.
From the standpoint of, again, it's a choice, isn't it? People have to choose to, I guess, want more, to disconnect from something that's artificial. But that just seems like kind of a jump because everybody, most people, our society in general, is glorifying being connected. and technology is awesome and science is everything. It's actually the opposite of what we should be thinking, isn't it?
You know, and furthermore, I think we glorify busy. It's the fact that we're always true. Have to be connected and busy all the time. You know, I look at when I'm most connected is when I'm in nature. And when I'm least alone is when I'm in solitude. And that sounds odd to someone who hasn't had that experience before. Mm. But there's a very real sense for me that when I'm out in nature and there's no other human being around, and then nature starts to kind of open up to me where I'm just still and I'm sitting. And now the squirrels will get a little bit closer. And the birds, they're maybe not doing their alarm calls anymore. Now they're getting a little bit closer too. There's the sense that when we stop just stomping on the planet and just being our ego-driven selves, that if we just open ourselves up and say, I want to feel the world around me, I'm doing that in a safe place. I'm doing that in a safe, you know, inner space as much as outer space. You will then feel more connected than you ever will being on the internet. At least that's my personal experience. And so, you know, once you see that, once you experience that, you can't unsee it. Once you have that experience, you will look at everything differently. So it only takes one moment, literally just one moment in that space to turn the whole thing around for you to be able to say, this is what I've been missing all along. My healing is within nature. I am a natural being. I have to return to this, and I will try every day a little bit more to get back into this space again.
That's really very empowering to feel that. And I just want everybody to get to where you are, where it's reality actually, and you're living it and you are glorying in it. I mean, there's something very positive about something, your nucleus of your essence. And you being able to connect with that, not to sound too esoteric, but everything is just coming from outside in. And the value that's being foisted on us, making us think that having likes makes us valuable. Having, you know, friends on the internet makes us valuable. Having being an influencer makes us valuable. And in actuality, it doesn't. It's being able to connect with the higher energy being to actually live a truth, not somebody else's truth.
Absolutely. And then what is your intrinsic value?
Yeah.
And by that, I mean, what is the thing that you can bring to this world that absolutely nobody else can do? You're only going to find that. Believe me, you're only going to find that when you're in that space, when you're feeling connected and you have that little message come down to you, that higher calling. Well, this is where I need to go. You know, this is what I need to do next. And the more you expose yourself to that state, the more that message is going to come through louder and louder and clearer until finally it just becomes so ingrained in who you are that that's where you lead from. That, you know, we live a balanced life. You know, we're going to interact with other people. We're going to have devices around us. But if we begin from that state of this is where I'm leading, I'm leading from this heart-centered consciousness in connection with nature, in connection with my life's purpose, everything else will be subservient to that.
Actually, I have a question in terms of the electromagnetic side of this and being heart-centered. Isn't the heart an electromagnetic organ?
Absolutely. And far more than the brain, for instance. You know, we can measure electrical signals from the heart with an EKG, and we can measure them from the brain with an EEG. And the heart, the actual field, the magnetic, electromagnetic field from the heart extends further out from the body than the brain does. It's a stronger signal in the end. There are actually more nerve signals going from heart to brain than the other way around. The heart's what's ruling the roost. It definitely is checking out what's going in the blood. It's getting that information from every cell of the body, and then it's reporting what it finds to the brain. And so the heart is a sensing organ, probably more so than anything that we think about. You know, the heart, yeah, it's a pump. Well, it's a lot more than a pump. In fact, it's not even a really good pump. It really just, you know, the blood comes back up to the heart pretty much by the action of all the muscles and the capillaries and such. The heart is doing a lot more than just pushing the blood around. It has this sensing organ. It's a sensing organ of letting our brain and the rest of our body know what's going on a moment-to-moment basis.
So it would follow then that this electromagnetic pollution that we're dealing with that is EMF-driven could interfere with our ability, honestly, to be able to look in, to self-regulate, to actually live, you know, in that heart-centered manner.
I think so. I think that's correct. You know, there's a way that people can kind of get clouded. You know, you and I both probably see it. Brain fog is a pretty big symptom that a lot of people have. Mm-hmm. And some of that could just be due, they're just fatigued, right? They just don't get enough sleep. But I actually do find that there's a way that there's this wool that's being pulled over people's eyes and what things we're being exposed to. And some of that's chemical toxicity. But I think a lot of that, when people really disconnect, I tell them, yeah, how is your brain fog if you were to go out camping for a few days and just really be out in nature? Yeah, it's fine. Doesn't really manifest then. Well, then you kind of see how the daily stresses that we're being exposed to and the environments we're being exposed to are really clouding us over in ways we didn't think about.
That's fascinating. And when you think about it that way, it gives you just, you have an antidote to this, which is to disconnect and go into nature and, you know, actively remove yourself from this so you have insight. And a lot of people need to do that, quite frankly.
You'd be amazed at what things clear up. You know, sometimes chronic insomnia will clear up. Sometimes headaches, migraines will clear up when people are out from artificial lights. You know, a whole slew of things can stand to get better once you just, you know, change the environment like that. And then you have the introspective moment, like, okay, so then what's really driving it? Mm-hmm. Then you got to go home and really think deeply about what you're being exposed to and how it's affecting you.
Well, at least you're making a move instead of letting it happen to you. Now, you mentioned in the book that you talk about shielding and some of the strategies that people can use, aside from just turning your phone off, if you have to use these devices. Do you recommend things like not getting rid of, but changing your Wi-Fi and wiring things, for example?
Absolutely. And I did that in my home and office. So we're completely on Ethernet, so we don't have any Wi-Fi anymore. And you can do that with the great many devices that you use, certainly computers, laptops. You know, you could choose to have a hardwired phone again. I even have a Ethernet connection going to a Roku box that has for streaming for stuff on TV. I mean, mm-hmm. So there's when there's a will, there's a way. You can figure out how to do those kinds of things and opt out from the greater thrust of the Wi-Fi devices that we're being exposed to.
For those folks who have things like the smart, you know, refrigerators and those sorts of things, can they disconnect those from the internet or turn them off in any way?
Oh, not very easily, unfortunately. In many instances, those things are pretty much how they come. And unless you're going to take the thing apart and void your warranty, it's probably not very practical. What I generally suggest is, you know, don't buy those appliances in the first place, which is what I've done. Or second, whenever they do go at some point, you know, and you need to replace it, that's when you can make a better choice about something else that's not as smart. Dumb appliances still work too.
So my next question is electric cars, since that seems to be where we're being pushed into. Are they safe or will they affect you like EMF would?
Yeah, it depends. So I'm kind of nerdy about this, and I bought a bunch of meters when I was doing the research for my book. So to be clear, the alternator of any even old-fashioned gas engine produces a lot of EMF. It produces a pretty potent magnetic field. But what you're describing now is the electric field that could be coming from different electric cars. And the answer to that, of course, is the perennial, it depends. Some cars, like I measured a Toyota hybrid, a Prius, you know, the battery's in the back seat. So unfortunately, the people in the back seat are getting blasted more than the people in the front seat. And that happens every time that the car brakes. Every time you put your foot on the brake and energy is getting diverted back into the battery is when you get a pulse of electromagnetic fields. Interestingly enough, Teslas, which are all electric, the battery is on the floor of the vehicle. And yeah, you can get a pretty strong signal, but it only happens at the level of the feet. Now, whether or not that's better in the long haul, it remains to be seen. So what I would say is all cars have some form of electromagnetic field that they're emitting. It's just in different locations, depending on the car.
That's good to know. And in terms of shielding, do these shielding devices that you put on your phone or your Bluetooth, do they work? Do you think that that's worth adding that in?
Depends on the device. Some of them, you know, there are companies definitely that you could put your cell phone in as a case and then close it. And mm-hmm. So that it's blocking on one plane. You know, it can't block entirely, otherwise you wouldn't get a cell phone signal. Mm-hmm. But it can at least try to block it in the plane of orientation that's going towards the body. I have measured these, and what I will tell you is that yes, they are helpful, but they are not foolproof in the sense that they will tell you in their advertising that, you know, they block 99 or less. I forget exactly what percentage. And I measure them with my meters, and it seems like it's far less than that. So I think there's a little bit of hype attached to them. I'll tell you a fun, quick story. I contacted one of the companies and said that, you know, I'm using my meters here. I'm not getting nearly the buffering of the field that you suggest that these devices should be doing. And their reply back was, well, you're not doing this in a laboratory setting. My response, of course, is who uses their cell phone in a laboratory setting? So, you know, clearly there's a bunch of marketing hype surrounding that. I mean, are they better than nothing? Probably. They think they are helpful. If I rarely actually use my cell phone since I have landlines like I'm speaking to you right now. But if I had to, like in an airport, for instance, I just go back to a wired headset, just use that.
Got you. So wired headsets are better than wireless Bluetooth then, technically?
Correct.
Okay.
Yep, correct.
You know, time goes way too quickly, but it goes when you're having fun, right? So I want to make sure that people know how to reach you if they need to and get your books.
Sure. So pretty much the clearinghouse for everything that I do is at BrandonLagreca.com. And my last name is spelled LAGRECA. So BrandonLagreca.com. And there are a few things there. You'll have access to all my books in all various forms. I write a monthly blog, which appears on that site. And also, in many different spots of that site, you'll see an opportunity to sign up for my monthly newsletter. And I just contact people once a month. And that's where you can find out where I'll be speaking, any classes that I'm going to be having, both online or in person, and then any future work coming up. I'm just putting the finishing touches now on my third book, which is going to delve more deeply into trauma as it relates to cancer. So that's coming up. And if you want to kind of find out when that's released, get more information or a little sneak peek, little snippets of writing, feel free to join my newsletter and we'd love to have you.
Oh, thank you. I'd love to have you back when the book publishes, because I think that's another topic that's huge that I would love to have your take on so that people can start, knowledge is power, right? So start engaging, learning, and not being afraid of what you don't know, because that's how you stay out of trouble.
Certainly. Dr. George, it's always an honor to speak with you, and thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much. And thank you, everybody, for living in the solution.
Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Liberty Talk FM.